Good evening again. Well, we're in a True Grit kind of format, so in a little while you will have the opportunity to grab the microphone, share your thoughts, your wisdom, your experience, or anything else that you have to offer in the midst. So please be prepared and willing to do that. I've told a story many times, and I don't know if I've told it here, but I'll tell it anyway, and if you don't laugh, I know I've already told the story. But there's a little lad, he goes to Sunday school. If you recognise this story, just put your hand up partway through it, and I'll stop saying it. But a little lad, he goes to Sunday school. He's been going to Sunday school for quite some time. His mum doesn't go to church, but his mum sends him to Sunday school. And one day, he comes home after being at Sunday school, and he says to his mum, next Sunday, I've been told to bring a cucumber to Sunday school. Anyone heard the story? Anyway, I'll keep going. So mum's thinking, well, that's interesting. It's not harvest or anything like that. So she's kind of pondering this all week, thinking about it. Little boy keeps reminding her, mum, don't forget, next Sunday, I've got to take a cucumber to church. So comes Sunday, he gets his cucumber, mum has bought his cucumber, he takes his cucumber to church, and mum's really fascinated. Normally mum doesn't pick him up from Sunday school, but this Sunday she makes sure she's down there nice and early, and she's really intrigued as to what the cucumber was for. So she goes in, as Sunday school finishes, she goes into the classroom, she goes up to the teacher, she says, so what did you use the cucumber for? And the teacher says, I didn't ask your son to bring a cucumber, but a newcomer to church. I haven't told that one before. I used to tell it all the time, so I did wonder whether I've ever told it here at Eastleigh. I picked that story up in Reader's Digest, so apparently this is a true story. Well, if you can trust Reader's Digest. That shows how old the story is. I've been telling it for about 20 years now. My dad kind of kept Reader's Digest, and I remember flicking through, seeing this story. But as soon as I read that story, I thought, isn't that interesting? We as Christians are better at bringing cucumbers to church than newcomers, aren't we? We're not very good at sharing our faith and bringing new people to discover who Jesus is. And yet, is that not our calling? Is that not part of what it was to become a Christian? When we became a Christian, it wasn't just our ticket to heaven, although there is that great hope and promise in our Lord and our Saviour. But it was also this calling on our lives, that we would join a movement of people that would share what we knew about Jesus to others. We know, of course, the Great Commission in Matthew 28. All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me, says Jesus. Therefore, you go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I am with you always to the very end of the age. We're going to kind of grapple with that issue about reaching others. I thought it may be a good time in these True Grit sessions to look at what it means to share my faith with others. What does it mean to tell others about Jesus in this day and in this age? Nigel Wright, the Reverend Nigel Wright, not the Professor Nigel Wright or T. Wright, but the Baptist Nigel Wright, who used to be the principal of Spurgeon's College and was also the president of the BU, in his presidential year, doesn't that sound grand? In his presidential year, I remember him being at the Baptist Assembly. It was the first Baptist Assembly we attended, actually. And because we attended it, we got a special session right at the beginning of the Baptist Assembly to meet the president of the Baptist Union. Really excited. So we met Nigel Wright with about 80 other people, so we weren't the only ones. And he kind of did this little message, which he kind of continued through his year. And one of the things that he said that we as Christians, when we're converted, there is a threefold conversion that should take place in our lives. Threefold conversion. We, of course, are converted to follow Jesus. We make a decision to belong to him. Yes, we all know that. But it's not just that. When we give our lives to Jesus, we are converted to each other. Well, if you stopped and thought about that, but how we see Jesus affects the way that we see each other. That you and I become brothers and sisters in Jesus Christ. We become one body. We become one people. be careful, I could go off on one on that one, but we're converted to each other. I mean, it's worth going away and pondering what that means in this day and age, to be one, committed to each other as God's church. But there's a third conversion which Nigel Wright wanted to emphasize, and he believed that we as Christians needed to be converted to the world. Well, what he meant by that, to be reconverted to the world, to actually love the world as Jesus loved the world, to love people as Jesus loved people, to have that kind of energy and emotion that Jesus felt. Chris did a very good job of talking about the compassion of Jesus this morning, having that compassion for the world, feeling how God feels about the world. He created the world. He created human beings. How does God feel about your neighbors who do not know him and are journeying in the wrong way and not the right way? And do we feel that? Are we converted to them, the lost, if you want? Quite often in True Grits, we don't have a Bible reading, but we're going to have a Bible reading. So if you'd like to turn to Luke 15, and I'm going to read you a very well-known parable. And I think, well, it's very difficult to choose your favourite parable, isn't it? But this has got to be certainly up there for me, this little parable. And I apologise because I've preached on this parable many, many times. So you could get a whole sermon and then another one, but I'll try and keep it short. But Luke 15, verses 1 onwards. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathered around to hear him, listening to Jesus. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, "This man welcomes sinners and eats with them." Then Jesus told them this parable. Suppose one of you had 100 sheep and loses one. Does he not leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? Question. What's your answer to that question? If you had 100 sheep, would you leave 99 in the open countryside and go after the lost sheep so that you might find it? Answer, probably not, if you were a sensible shepherd. You would cut your losses and stick with 99. That would have been the answer. But this shepherd, mad that he is, when he finds it, he goes looking for the sheep. And when he finds it, he joyfully puts the sheep on his shoulders and goes home. He calls his friends and neighbors, and together he says, "Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep." After they have a big party, this is not written in here. After they have a big party, the morning is coming in. He kind of staggers out with his lost sheep. He then goes to find his 99 sheep. And what does he discover? He's got 99 lost sheep and just one sheep, hasn't he? Conrad Gent, who was one of my lecturers and still at LST, London Bible College, he said that this parable probably was a joke. They were probably laughing, partly because shepherds were always a joke. In Jesus' time, biblical times, shepherd jokes were rife. Have you heard the one about? Have you heard the one about the shepherd who had 100 sheep? And he counted them and he found he had 99 and one had gone missing. And so he left 99. I mean, when we kind of tell children this story and write it in books, so you know it's the books, the children's books, they always put a pen around the sheep and lassie at the gate. There was no pen and there was no lassie. Jesus was at lengths to say 99 sheep were left in the open hillside. He leaves 99 sheep to find his lost one. Madness. But the point is exactly that. That's how God feels about those who are lost. The Pharisees and the tax collectors thought they were safe. They were the 99 that were okay. So Jesus says God is like a mad shepherd who leaves those who think they're fine and he'll go searching and searching and searching and looking for the lost one. And when he finds the lost one, he rejoices and he celebrates like a crazy mad shepherd, dancing and calling his friends to come and rejoice with him. That's the point of the story. I love this story. It's absolutely fantastic. And that is how we should feel about those who are lost. Rather than thinking, aren't we safe? Aren't we secure? How do we feel? How does God feel about not 1% that are lost, but as we were told at a conference last week, 93% in our country that are lost, that are no longer following after Jesus Christ. How does God feel? How do we feel? And what do we actually do about that? So part of this kind of Reaching the Lost series within the True Grit format is kind of thinking about how we share the precious gift of Jesus Christ. Now, to do that, what I wanted to do, the first two sessions, so this session and the next session, is to actually begin to think about the world in which we live. Because to reach the lost, if you're a shepherd, if you're going to find a lost sheep, the terrain is really important. To know your terrain. The shepherd, mad that he was and a bit crazy for leaving 99 on the open hillside, probably knew his stuff. He knew where to look. He knew where the sheep might be and to search for them. And we need to understand the terrain in which we are, because things aren't always the same. And the world in which we live is changing. Now, this may sound like a history lesson for the next few minutes, but I want you to stick with it if you can, okay? If you can't, well, I apologize. But I want to talk about modernity to post-modernity. We live in what many call a post-modern society today. But to understand the world in which we live today, we need to understand where we have come from, what is called modernity. A guy called Thomas Oden defined the modernist period from starting in 1789 at the fall of Bastille and ending in 1989, 200 years of modernity, at the fall of the Berlin Wall. Some have disagreed with him, but if you kind of take that 200 years, it's quite convenient. Can you just turn me down just a bit? I can hear myself ringing around the church. Why was the birth of modernity important? It began at the storm. Well, it didn't begin. The symbol of modernity beginning was at the storming of Bastille in Paris, which was the prisons in Paris. And the prisons, the Bastille in Paris, were symbolizing a symbol of the authority of the monarchy, a symbol of royal tyranny in that time of France, particularly. And kind of what led on from here was the French Revolution, if you know your history. I'm not a great historian, but I have done a bit of research. So what actually happened is the revolution took place. There was a storming of the Bastille, political prisoners. Actually, there were only seven people in the prison at the time. Isn't that interesting? There were only seven people, and they were very annoyed. Some of them were mad, because actually the political prisoners had already been released. But this was symbolic. This was a symbolic act that was taking place. The people were taking charge and taking over. Those political prisoners were released. There was exaltation of the rights of man and the citizen against the monarchy and the church. This is important. And the church. Because, of course, the monarchy and the church were the authority. They were the power. And this was a great revolution against that. As part of this revolution, Christianity was demised or dismissed as a relic. It's interesting, isn't it? More than 200 years ago. During the revolution, the goddess of reason was installed in Notre Dame Cathedral. Human reason was expected to take the place of God. Understanding and science became the most important thing. And so the modern age began, a remaking of society along the lines of science and rational truth, a rejection of anything supernatural. The new age was fueled by the growth of science and human invention, the Industrial Revolution, of course, urbanization, growth of cities. And alongside that, biblical criticism. So the Bible was kind of taken and criticized from beginning to end, and the growth of atheism, particularly. And eventually, it would give birth, of course, to communism and the Marxist state. However, in the midst of that, at the beginning of this new era, this new time, the church was kind of dismissed as a relic, and yet it survived. And yet Christendom continued. It changed the way the church was and its functions and the way it reached out to people changed, but it continued and in some cases even flourished. So where are we now? Well, we're actually at the death of modernism. Actually, the modernism has kind of died, and we're in this what we call postmodern era. Key events If I disappear there. Oh, key events that symbolise that change, particularly through the 1960s. Many would talk about the 1960s being the end of the modern era. So on, after the Second World War into the 60s, moving away from that kind of leaning towards reason and science to actually an embracing of, embracing of campaigning against many of those things. I'm going to put up a picture of the, and I'm not sure how you pronounce this. Does anyone know how you pronounce this? The Pruitt-Igoe housing development? Is that? This housing development was built in 1954 in St. Louis, Missouri. Many, many millions of dollars were poured into this. We okay? Do you want me to switch with Julie? How's that? See how that goes. Many millions of dollars were poured into this place. This was meant to be the great architecture of modernism. It was a complete and utter failure. And in the 70s, this place was blown up. So it didn't last very long. They blew the whole lot up. It was a prize-winning exemplar of high technology, modernist aesthetics and functional design. The project was so impersonal and depressing, so crime-ridden and impossible to patrol, and it was uninhabitable, and so they blew the thing up eventually. And many say that that was kind of a symbol of the end of the modern period. But I think, actually, the first guy that I mentioned, what was his name again? Thomas Oden, who's actually a Christian, that the Berlin Wall is an even stronger symbol of the dying of modernism. Because the Berlin Wall coming down was the death of communism, if you want, which was was born out of modernism. That kind of idea that there was no God and that actually community and society was the most important thing would actually take place. And so there was this kind of rebellion against all that had taken place into a new age. Of course, all the way through the modern period, the church had been kind of engaged with it, changing its structures, changing its communication, changing its style. Preaching was great in the modern era. Kind of reason and logic was really important. So when someone spoke a word, you know, people would flock in. The Victorian preachers, like Spurgeon, for example, would have hundreds and hundreds of people coming to hear them within that modern period. But those times have now passed. And I want to give you 10 things that have changed that impact the church as we enter into or have entered into what we now call the postmodern era. I'm going to do 4 today, you'll be glad to know, and then I'm going to do the next 6 the next time we get together. Here's the first one. Absolute truth is replaced with questioning. The postmodern person or culture is suspicious of any absolute authority and questions everything. If you actually think about your school, it would be fascinating if we had time to talk about schooling here. Some of you older folk will remember this kind of teacher. The one who taught you facts. In fact, put your hand up if you remember school being kind of very factual. So you'd be given facts of history. And okay, now put your hand up if you remember school as being developing you to question and to work it out for yourself. So the generational. See, I am 60. What am I? No, I'm not. I'm 46. Born in 1967. That's right. Which is absolutely key because that's kind of in the bubble of change. And when I went to school, yes, we were given certain amounts of facts, but there was a big change in education taking place. And the big change was actually trying to develop you to critique what you're listening to question, to work it out for yourselves, and a shift from shared facts to a kind of individual understanding of life and working it out for yourselves. Politicians, teachers, policemen, social workers, doctors and churches were no longer the bastions or the strongholds of truth and respect. That was beginning to disappear. Tolerance and respect of others was held high, much higher than any belief system. So, you know, you may have beliefs and values, but actually tolerance of the other person was more important, whereas before it was about the belief system. So what does that mean for Christianity in the church? Just declaring truth no longer convinces people. Standing on the street, on your little kind of box, and preaching at people, you may have noticed that is rarely seen nowadays because it's not effective. In a modern era, it was. You go to Preacher's Corner, and you can engage with the discussion and the debate that was going on, and people would flock and listen and could be convinced by the declaration of truth. Today, just declaring truth will not convince people particularly. Some may be, but generally, no. Instead, people need space and time to question, to think it through and work it through. Conversion is not an event. Very rarely nowadays do you hear of people becoming a Christian like that. Suddenly hearing the truth of Jesus Christ and saying, tell me how to become a Christian. It's very rare. I mean, sometimes it happens, but it's very rare. For most people, it's not an event. And when you talk to people who have recently become Christians, if you say, when did you become a Christian? Do you remember, you know, many of you will be able to name the date and the time and the place. You ask some people becoming Christians today, when did you become a Christian? They'll go, I don't really know when I became a Christian, because it's not an event. It's a process. It's a gradual process of questioning and working through. Friends, this is really important, I think. I mean, this really hit me. I wrote this down and suddenly read my own notes and went, oh, wow. Friends are more important than preachers. Do you hear that? Friends are more important than preachers. If Billy Graham came to our country, I don't think he'd fill stadiums today. He may, because he's a big name, but you don't get the big evangelist today. Why? Because people don't flock. So what has happened? The responsibility of sharing faith with others has suddenly dissipated out, that each and every one of us has a responsibility to befriend people. Because friendship is more important than being preached at. Toby wants to apologize now because he needs to disappear, and it's because I've just upset him. No, it's not really. It's because he has to go. And does it pick up someone? Yeah. So this whole movement of how truth and questioning, how the truth has been replaced with question, is an absolute key one for us to kind of engage with and think about. I need to move on because otherwise I won't get my 4 points in, let alone my 10 points. Here's the second thing then. Corporate rights are replaced with individual rights. Or put a different way, individual responsibilities are replaced with corporate responsibilities. Corporate straitjacketing, at best fitting into the status quo and at worst living within a communist regime where the society needs to outweigh the needs and the right of the individual, has led to an outbreaking of individualism. You probably didn't understand a word of that, did you? Let me break that down. The idea in the modernist age, corporate straitjacketing, making everyone the same, that was seen at its worst in communism, where you as a person weren't important. What was important was society and how you played your role within that. Today has dissipated, and out of that has been an outbreaking of individualism, that I am important. And actually, partly, we want to say, yeah, individuals are important. Sadly, within our society, at the demise of the community. I'm going to suggest in the next point that actually community isn't something that people engage with today, not in the old-fashioned ways. It's fascinating talking to some of our older generation, and you may want to input in to this conversation, because when you talk to some of, and I'm kind of pointing to this side of the room, I don't know why, but I think the average age may be a little bit... When you talk to some of these folks about coming through the war and just after the war, the sense of community was really, really strong. That sense of society, being together, belonging together. You know, we weren't worried about the famous person or the pop star, not so much. I mean, in the 60s, that kind of began, you know, the uprising of fame became quite important. But even football stars weren't that famous. Society was key. So individualism wasn't important. It's about looking after the community. And that society, the individual had responsibility to society. But now, society has responsibility for the individual. Individual responsibility is a choice rather than a given. You can't expect, it would be nice if we could expect, but people aren't particularly... always willing to give responsibility into society, but they know their rights. They know what their rights are. Even kids know their rights, don't they, Julie? You go to school, even the little ones. I know my rights, miss. You come near me, I'll have you in court. And all those kind of things. They know their rights. What does that mean in terms of Christianity and the church, the impact on the church? Well, it means this. See, church is very much a community-based thing. But church attendance now is a choice, not a responsibility. In the past, you wouldn't even think of not going to church. If I could take you back 50, 60, 70 years ago, it would not even come into your head to think you wouldn't go to church. Because your responsibility is to be with the community, to be with the society. But of course, today... it is a choice. It is a complete and utter choice. And we as Christians have to understand that. That expectation that people will flow in with a sense of responsibility to worship God just no longer exists. Does the Christian faith meet my needs? That's a question we need to ask. Because individuality means it's very individual focus. And we might not like that, but actually... people are interested in how Christianity meets their needs. Here is another thing that I wrote down and kind of hit me between the eyes. People no longer are so concerned about spiritual sin, but are more concerned about social needs. Now, when it comes to talking to people about faith and them becoming Christians, so often we as Christians lean on salvation of sin. And I think that's important. But most people have no concept of sin. They don't have that sense of responsibility and how their actions kind of ricochet out and how that affects other people. What they're more concerned about is their social needs and the things that they face. In fact, you all these things, all their worries in life, their bag of worries, that's what they're concerned about. They haven't got a bag. It's interesting you went with a bag of worries rather than a bag of sins. You're very postmodern. You are what we are. But this bag of needs and worries and concerns are far greater in the minds and the hearts and the lives of people than the sins, the lies, the greed, the lust, and all those things that would be in a different bag. Those things are kind of, you know, their eyes aren't open to those things and the effect of those things upon their lives. So that's quite a big kind of difference. Let me move on to the I'll do the third one. We'll see how time goes. These two are connected, so I wanted to do the third one. Community, we've already talked about community. Community is replaced with network. Network is quite a modern word, but actually it's a good one. Community is fixed and requires commitment. To be part of a community, you've got to kind of feel that you belong and have some responsibility to it. Whereas network is functional and can be opted in and out when the necessity arises. Belonging is fluid, not fixed. Are you with me on that? Very, very different kind of... I mean, we still use the word community, but community has changed. There isn't that sense of together and always together. We stand shoulder to shoulder. Whatever comes our way, be it the Nazis or anything else, we will stand, or the Welsh in their rugby team. Are the Welsh here? There isn't that same sense that we will always stand together. There's that sense that I opt in and I opt out. I mean, I quite like this picture. I don't know if you can see, there's a man behind that. I couldn't get the fuller picture in. But he's kind of, you know, I'll be part of this network, and then I'll be part of that network, and I could be part of that network. But I come out of that network because I now need to be part of this network. And so community and relationships are more network, more fluid, and very, very a great deal of movement of people flowing in and out, in and out. And we see that more and more through the internet particularly, but it's in other forms of relationship as well. What's the impact on the church? Well, the church is no longer fixed, but fluid. The church is moving. There are people flowing into the church, and there are people, yes, even flowing out of church. I'm not happy about that. I like people flowing in. I'm not so keen about people flowing out. But there is the potential of people flowing out. What does it mean for us? Initiatives that churches or an outreach particularly may be more temporary rather than permanent. So in the past, in the modern era of church, the style of church and style of outreach, there is a sense that this works and always will work because there's a kind of a static. But in a postmodern society, things are changing and moving very, very quickly for many, many different reasons. And that may mean that some things are not as effective or no longer efficient in terms of what they once did. And so some things become more temporary. So it may mean that churches say, this is an era to do this. Here is a moment to grab hold of this and go with it, knowing that actually it may be a temporary thing rather than the permanent thing. Churches must get used to closing down past and dying initiatives. Or we just keep them going until they do die. And that takes energy, of course. But there are some things we have to recognise that are actually serving an era that has passed rather than an era that is coming. And change is here to stay. You know, if you've kind of seen a lot of change in church life, get used to it. If you've seen a lot of change in society, get used to it. And I must admit, I'm not someone who particularly enjoys change. Every time there's this new gadget, I mean, people like Paul love it. They go, a new gadget, great, kind of immerse. People like Chris immerse themselves into the new thing, and I'm like, oh, no. Another thing to learn, another new language, another new function, another new way of doing life. I'm really kicking against Facebook, but I feel myself being dragged into this wave of this thing called Facebook and Twitter and goodness knows what else. But actually society is changing. And we as Christians need to recognize that, understand it, and recognize that actually change becomes part of the ingredient of life. What does that mean for churches? Well, church structures must be versatile, light touch, rather than cumbersome and heavy-handed. And I think that's a challenge for us. I mean, we as church meeting will gather together and we'll be talking about leadership. And one of the areas of leadership we'll be talking about is deacons and diaconate and structures of leadership and how leadership might work well and efficiently and biblically for the future. And actually, when you think about it, most of our Baptist churches' structures are based on modernist age, on a church that grew up in the modern age rather than the postmodern age. And in a postmodern age, which is changing rapidly and moving, where people are interested in networks rather than community, we have to ask the question, what works well in that society so that we can adjust and change to actually meet their needs? Have we got time for the fourth one? Yeah, I'll do the fourth one very quickly, because I haven't got a lot to say about the fourth one. Fourth one is this. Image is replacing reality. What you think of me is more important than who I actually am. Within the postmodern age, there's a massive growth in fashion and branding. You talk to young people, and they want to be the famous person, the person that gets all the love. The importance of wearing and having the right things replace the reality of being able to afford them. Does that kind of resonate with people? It's what I look like. I've kind of chose this picture, not to pick on women particularly, because even men now, I mean, I at Christmas, I get so many lotions and potions. I don't know what to do with them. Maybe people think I need them. I don't know. They're probably absolutely right. But actually, image is everything. What we look like is everything. Why is that important? Well, it's important partly because the church has an image problem. We could do with some makeup. Well, perhaps not. But the church, I mean, I want to use this term because it's very in. Church particularly isn't very sexy, is it? That's kind of, you know, used quite, it's a very strange word to use for certain things. But it's all about image. It's about looking the part. And church has an image problem. It's not particularly interested in its image quite often. We don't spend a lot of time at the mirror. And I'm not suggesting we should. I think we just have to recognize the culture that we're in. Our communication isn't as slick as other bodies and groups out there. But also, it impacts us because the church is seeking to reach people who have been convinced that the value of life comes from what they look like rather than who they are. And that's a very different place. If I'm reaching out to a person who is a child of God and who recognizes that they need God in their life, that's a very different, and that's a reality, that's a very different place to a person who is trying to look the part and trying to be loved by what they wear and what they look like or what they have particularly. And because of that, we find that the church message or the Christian message is working against the flow of culture. Because often people have misunderstood what life is about. And so they're running after things to fulfill their lives. And we're actually trying to say, actually, that isn't important. You know, what you look like doesn't matter. What your weight is, whether you're thin or fat, old or young, doesn't actually matter. What matters is that God loves you. It doesn't matter that people think you're wonderful. What matters is that God thinks you're wonderful. And many, many people need to hear that message. But when that message is anti the message of culture, sometimes that's hard. Sometimes that's difficult. And sometimes we find ourselves being caught up in the cultural message that we need to look the part. I read a fascinating article about worship leading. And this worship leader was a woman, and she'd written about how only certain people can lead worship. She wasn't saying this, but she's saying we're falling into what she called kind of sexy worship leaders. That they look attractive in the front. That your worship leader's got to look attractive. They've got to be attractive men or attractive ladies. And actually, when you stop and think about big conferences, and I don't want to pick on any particular one because I'll have the young people after me, but if you kind of look at videos and songwriters, who are the successful ones? They're often the ones who look the part rather than that are leading people into the place or the throne of God. I thought she had a point, actually, that even in church, we have fallen into the trap of image rather than reality. I remember Chris, not here, so I won't embarrass him, because hopefully he'll never know, but he may listen to this. But I remember Chris saying, when you were in the interregnum, all the different people that you had who came to preach, he said it was fascinating. The ones that came all smart and looking kind of all polished, were okay, but it was the ones who came with rags who really kind of touched his heart with the word of God. Isn't that fascinating? And often I've found that. You know, often those who aren't interested about image, but more interested in what God is saying, brings the truth of what God is saying into the life of the community of God's people. But that's the battle that we're in, that we have to face. Image versus reality. Okay, we're finished there. I've got six others to kind of bombard you with, but I think it's quite important that we kind of grasp some of this change that is taking place. And many churches are grappling with this. Churches was always behind on culture. It was always behind. But with the help of the Spirit of God, church is always renewed, transformed, so that it might reach the people of its time. It'd be fascinating to hear some of your thoughts and comments and how you feel about some of those things. So anyone like to kick us off? Anything kind of... You don't have to agree with everything I say, by the way. We haven't got Toby here to kick us off today, so you're going to have to... Go on, Anne, and then we'll go to Janet.
So how would you reach older people today? By just stating the truth or by getting them to question things?
How are you defining old people? So over 60s or?
Yes.
Yeah, kind of in that.
Well,
yeah. That's a good question. How would you?
I think they should be taught to question.
Oh, okay. All right. I mean, these are some of the questions that we need to grapple with, because as church, because we are in the in-between times to some extent. So you do have generation that would have been grown up in a slightly more modern age, and then you've kind of got a young generation that is certainly grown up in a very, very postmodern age. Janet?
I was just remembering, I think a minister from Windsor on the footsteps course who came along and said, do you know, we cannot get people to commit to church membership, so we've given up trying. Mm-hmm. And what we do is they say to people, it links in with your joining and not joining, will you please commit to being a member for 1 year? And he's done it like that, because otherwise they were not even getting the quorum in the church meeting. So he said, that's what they've done. And that has worked in that, fortunately, people have joined for a year and then stayed on. But they weren't at the beginning willing to commit forever.
Yeah. I mean, commitment is not a modern word, no, postmodern word, if you want. It's not a word for our culture. And you find that in marriage. And you find that with couples that won't get married because they won't commit, because they're scared of the word or the thing of commitment that is forever and a day. It is fascinating. And a membership does ask for that commitment, doesn't it? You're quite right. Yeah. Paul?
Just actually leading on from your comments on commitment, going back to what you were saying about thinking of the roles of deacons and so on like that, this also applies to ministers to some extent. Very few people have a sense of calling to a lifetime commitment. And, you know, you think, all right, there were disadvantages of it. But dear old Joe was a deacon for 35 years. And then he was made a life deacon as well, sort of thing. Mm. Nowadays, I think, I question even whether we need to have the three-year term with only one renewal in deacons. There's a part of me says, yes, you want that commitment. But there's a recognition almost of, like many businesses, getting the deacon for the task and then letting he or her stand down in that way. And we're seeing amongst ministers. I mean, nowadays, I quite often speak to young men in their early 40s. Sorry, Joel. but who've been to theological college and so on like that, gone into ministry for 10, 12 years, and then pulling out of ministry and going into a completely different era as well. So, you know, I think it reflects upon us as well. I must admit, with your reference to the Welsh, when I played rugby, I played in the scrum because I enjoyed being part of that pack together. Mm. I wasn't interested in wandering around on the outside.
Yeah.
And I have to confess, I had, as I grew up, I had no interest in individual games like golf. I played a bit of tennis, but you know, they just didn't appeal to me. I wanted a group game within the community.
Yep. Thanks, Paul. I mean, it's fascinating. I thought you were going to go on and talk about the type of ministers we have, but I think that's also...
Well, that's also true.
Because this whole idea of hierarchy, you know, the minister who's the teacher of the church and all those kind of things, you know, the Spurgeons, what was that kind of minister?
Nowadays, you're getting churches with five or six ministers.
Yeah.
There's the pastoral minister, there's the preaching minister,
a big discussion about bivocational ministry as well going on in the Baptist Union. Richard?
Well, just putting it out there a little bit, just made a few scribbles here. But, you know, before I came to church, I lived a very individual life, very sustaining for myself. And I found that actually becoming a part of church and learning a responsibility actually helped me become more of an individual because I had an individual role within that community, and I find that is what's brought me forward, and you know, it's just a thought.
Yeah, I mean, in the postmodern era, in terms of people want friendships and they want to be part of communities, but it's a very they mean that when they use those terms, they mean it very differently to how perhaps if I can pick on Joy, how you would have known community years and years ago. With words society, the word society is interesting because people don't use that word so much. Nowadays, that's the kind of word. But you would have known what society was about when you were a little girl. It's kind of everyone together, in and out of each other's homes, belonging together. That kind of is dissipated. But there's still this desire for relationship, community, but it's an opt-in, opt-out kind of thing. And that can affect church, of course, because people can opt in and opt out. It's kind of an easy thing. But we're glad to have you as part of our community. Network, whatever you want to call it, and I hope for a long time. Yeah, Joyce going to...
I think maybe the change goes even deeper in some way into what we believe. We talk about the kingdom of heaven. Nowadays, how many countries have got a king or a queen? We don't think in terms of a monarch.
Yeah.
So... how should our theology be phrased these days? It needs a whole new rethink to make it understandable to a society which no longer really thinks in terms of kings and queens.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, kings, queens, princes, it's all about fame and being known for that pretty thing of royalism. But... yeah, and there's so much. I mean, the word Lord, for example. What do people understand that? If we use that with our neighbours, what do they understand Lord to mean?
Yeah, very interesting because a lot of the people I work with, they don't like, well, they're very similar sort of age demographics sort of thing to me. The idea of submitting to some sort of authority to them is... possibly very, very alien compared to what it might be for a couple of generations before when it was expected that you'd submit to authority. That you see that in schools and stuff, submitting to authority to them is nothing they can sort of associate with in their heads.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. The whole area of authority and what authority is, because in the modern age, you know, if you were told, you were told. And that was still slightly in the school that I went to. You know, if the head told you, you jolly well knew, and you behaved yourself. But nowadays, I'm not sure if that is the case. And you're absolutely right. I think that whole idea of authority is a little bit alien. And so, if someone tries to be authoritarian, everyone's like, "Well, no, we don't want that. Thank you very much." So that's a challenge. And when we're telling people to fall to the authority of Jesus, that's it's a big, big, big thing. Anyone want the last word? I normally say, I normally say that, and then six people put their hands up. But
we've put this in the context of reaching out to people, But one of the questions we have to ask is, what are we losing because we've changed? We're throwing away concepts that actually are still real and are still essential. And how do we hold on to them even if we reformulate them? Because what we're assuming is that the changes that are taking place are right. And I question it.
Go on, have the last word.
I think with the breakdown of community, there are many lonely people who suffer because of that. We want to do our own thing and be individual, but then when things go wrong, we're left with nothing.
Yeah.
And how does the church reach them?
These are all great questions. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that all these things are good and right, but they are challenges. They are challenges, and if we ignore the challenge, so many churches ignore the challenge and therefore then lose their way in communicating and reaching out.
Can I just say that I just started something called 40 Acts Together, and it's over Lent. It's a church-led initiative on Facebook, actually. Sorry, Josh. And each day, they email you. So the first day, you start a journal, and you put your the things that you're thankful for and the things that you wish for. And then the second day, they send you an email, and they say, start a generosity jar. So I got my jam jar, put my pound in, and each day during Lent you put a bit of money in, and then you're going to use this jar later on in Lent for something, you don't know what. Day three was, go and speak to a neighbour and get to know your neighbours. And so I went off to the co-op and I didn't bump into any neighbours, and I thought, oh no, I'm going to fail. And anyway, so I thought, maybe if I'm out the front of my house cleaning my car, people might walk past and then I could say, hello, do you live down this road? Or something like that. And and actually it worked really well. And then I ended up walking down the road because someone was in their garden and I don't really speak to, and found out about this person. And it's a bit out of your comfort zone sometimes, isn't it? Because it's sort of somebody you don't know, just starting chatting with them. And then I found that more people kept coming and saying, thank you, Lord, thank you for giving me these people, because I didn't think I was going to see anybody. So I've written my list of these people. And then later on, during Lent, you're going to be doing something for these people. I think it's like baking a cake and taking it round or something like that. It's a really good initiative where you wouldn't maybe think of doing that yourself. But through this church initiative, it's something every day that we're doing towards Lent.
What's it called again?
It's called 40 Acts Together.
40 Acts Together. So if anyone wants to get on board, they could still get on board to do that. Thanks, Julie. Well, I mean, there's lots of food for thought there and lots of challenges. And, of course, I've got six other things to throw your way. I'm not sure when we next come to this, whether it's in April or whether it may be in May even. Shall we, when we start talking about culture, it can feel like this whole sort of a wind of kind of change that comes blowing through, and you can think, wow, what's happened? Particularly when you kind of face it in one kind of foul swoop like that. But always remember, our God is bigger than anything. And our God knows. And he understands people from the moment they were created. He also understands all the influences around them that make them think and hold certain beliefs or values or ways of thinking. God knows all that. And we have a mighty God who can change lives, don't we? Yes, we do. We do. God can change lives. Let's pray.